Okay, so picture this. It's January, Finland, 1973.
Cold.
So cold. You're 20 years old. You've been dropped like 5,000 miles from home into this world of perpetual twilight. It's 3 in the afternoon and the sun's already gone.
And you're shivering in a polyester suit.
In a polyester suit,
Yeah.
standing in a snowbank, trying to speak a language that the Foreign Service Institute ranks as a category fourth.
Which is, I mean, that's literally one of the hardest languages an English speaker can learn.
Exactly. And your job isn't just to survive, it's to convince complete strangers to completely change their spiritual lives.
It sounds like a recipe for a mental breakdown, honestly. But the documents we're looking at today, these journals and memoirs from missionaries like Burke Rees, Gary Carter, Jay Wiseman, they don't tell a story of defeat at all. They
Yeah.
tell a story of resilience, that is. It's almost irrational.
Welcome to the deep dive. We're unpacking the personal histories of this handful of young missionaries in these little Finnish towns, Jyväskylä, Kajaani, Kotka, in the mid-70s.
And I think we should be clear up front. The context is religious, sure, but the mechanics here are. They're universally human. This is a masterclass in what we're calling the long game.
It really is. It's about how these, chance encounters, missing a train, getting a free meal, a single prayer you forgot you even said, how they create these ripples that you might not see for 40 years.
That is the big theme in these journals. We live in a world that is just obsessed with immediate feedback. You post something, you get a like, you work, you get paid.
Right, instantly.
But these journals, they describe this economy of effort where the return on investment might not show up for decades. It really forces you to ask, how do you keep going when that feedback loop is just broken?
You find small victories. And for these guys, the first big victory was just understanding what people were saying to them. Let's start in Jyväskylä, June 1973. Burke Rees writes about this huge psychological shift he has.
He finally cracks the language code.
He does. But when you read his entry, it's not just about grammar. It was about no longer being a ghost in the machine,
Oh, absolutely. Before that, his situation was, it was dire. His old companion knew exactly two words of English.
Let's go.
Let's go, that's it. So Rees was just totally isolated. And when the language finally clicked, the whole world changed for him. He stops complaining about the cold in his journal and starts calling it the land of a thousand lakes.
He starts seeing the beauty because he finally has a voice.
And having that voice led him to this really charming relationship in the memoirs.
The Saxholm couple.
Yes, they owned a restaurant in town. They weren't members of the church, didn't really seem to care about theology at all.
No, but they saw these young Americans trying to get by on like nothing, and they basically adopted them.
It's that classic Finnish hospitality. The Saxholms insisted that Rees and his companion eat there for free. But think about the power dynamic there. Usually the missionary is trying to give the message, but here they had to be humble enough to just receive. That builds trust so much faster than a lecture.
And that trust paid off later in this
Yeah.
really hilarious way.
Sure.
Rees has to organize a big regional meeting, a zone conference,
Right.
and he needs to feed 24 hungry 20-year-olds.
Whoa.
So he goes to Mrs. Saxholm and he asks for, discount. He's probably hoping for 10% off.
And she just looks at him and says, the discount is 100%.
100%.
I mean, that is a huge contribution for a small business owner. It just shows that people buy into people long before they buy into ideas.
And Mr. Saxholm's reaction is my favorite part. He's listening to them talk one night and he just says, with complete sincerity, I have a feeling you two must be apostles.
Which is, the highest rank in their church.
The highest rank. And they get all awkward and correct him, like, no, we're sent by apostles. And he just shrugs and says, well, I was close then.
I love that. Because the connection wasn't about doctrinal precision. Mr. Saxholm didn't care about the org chart. He just felt this dedication in them, and he labeled it the best way he knew how.
Speaking of unexpected labels, we have to talk about the model. This is Jay Wiseman's story, also in Jyväskylä, and it sounds like something out of a movie.
It really does. If you put this in a novel, the editor would cut it for being too unrealistic.
Totally. So Wiseman's just standing outside the chapel, and this blonde woman walks up to him. And she tells him she felt a magnetic urge to come to the building.
Just out of nowhere. And she's not just some random person, she was a professional model.
Right. High status, busy life. Demographically, probably the last person you'd expect to stop and talk about religion on a street corner.
But she does. She investigates, she gets baptized, and then eventually moves to America. And here's that ripple effect we talked about.
Her children grow up and serve missions themselves.
So that one random magnetic urge on a sidewalk in Finland ends up sparking decades of service all over the globe. It just reinforces how unpredictable it all is. You can't profile who's ready for a change.
Let's pivot north. Up to Kajani. The years are 73 to 75. And if Chayvaskyle was about the joy of connection, Kajani feels more like a study in isolation. Gary Carter describes their meeting place as this gray, humble room in an old building. He calls it cheerless to the eye.
Cheerless physically, maybe?
Yeah.
But he contrasts that grayness with the spiritual environment that he says was ablaze.
Right.
This is where you see that sort of startup mentality applied to faith. In a huge congregation, you can just be a passenger. You can hide. But when the group is just five people, like it was in Kajani,
everyone has to be a driver.
Everyone's a driver. And the MVP driver of that group was Sister Korhonen.
Her story is incredible. The sources say she'd been a member since the 1940s. For over 20 years, she basically worshipped alone.
I can't even wrap my head around that kind of stamina. 20 years.
And the detail that really gets me is how she got her scriptures. She received the Book of Mormon serially.
Because the full translation wasn't finished yet.
Exactly. It was being translated and printed in sections.
Yeah.
So she'd get a few chapters in the mail, devour them, and then have to wait for months for the next little piece.
It creates this scarcity value that we don't understand today. We have all of scripture plus every commentary ever written right on our phones.
We scroll past it while we're waiting for the bus.
And she treated every single page like it was gold because she literally didn't know when the next one was coming. Scarcity breeds appreciation.
And that appreciation, it extended to the missionaries themselves. Because the group was so small, just a few women, the missionaries weren't just clergy. They were like adopted sons.
Carter's journal entries are so domestic.
They are. He talks about his socks being darned perfectly, his garments being pressed, and of course the food. Sister Mahonan's pima kaku.
Which I have to admit, sour milk cake does sound a little questionable.
It does, but Carter writes about it like it was manna from heaven. He said it tasted like home.
It's that maternal protection. When you're so outnumbered, the bond within that tiny group just tightens. You become fiercely loyal.
Which brings us to the most complex story in these journals, the real long game.
The story of Ritva Rihonen.
This one completely dismantles that hero missionary idea where one guy swoops in and saves the day.
Ritva's story is a relay race, but the runners didn't even know they were on the same team.
Okay, so lap one, 1973. Burke Rees and his companion, they meet Ritva. She's involved in this other movement, moral rearmament, and she's very skeptical.
She even tells them to their faces, you boys don't know anything about religion.
Brutal. So on paper, that's a failed contact. You mark it as a no, you move on.
But they pray with her, they leave a book, and then they leave.
Right. Now, lap two. It's 1975. 2 years later, Gary Carter and his companion are now teaching her, and something's changed.
She converts. But the catalyst wasn't some brilliant argument from Carter. It was a dream.
A dream about her father, who had passed away. He'd been a very proud, non-religious man. But in the dream, she sees him serving joyfully in a white temple.
And that image just bridged the gap for her. It connected the doctrine to her own family. It wasn't just about her anymore. It was about him, too.
So she gets baptized, becomes a pillar of the church there. Case closed, right? Carter gets the win.
Not quite. This is the part that gets me.
It's the twist. 40 years later. 40. Burke Rees gets an email from a mission president who was collecting these stories.
Yeah.
Ritva had submitted hers.
And she pinpointed the start of her journey, not to the dream, not to Carter's lessons in 75, but to that single prayer that Burke Rees offered in her home back in 73.
A prayer he probably forgot about the second he walked out her door.
He thought he'd failed. He left that house thinking, well, she thinks we're idiots. But that prayer just sat with her underground for 2 years, just softening her heart.
And this is the critical insight for anyone listening, I think. You are a terrible, terrible judge of your own impact.
Yes.
We judge our interactions on immediate feedback. A frown, an argument, we think we failed. Ritva's story proves the real impact often happens silently, long after you've left the room.
It's those invisible threads.
And sometimes those threads get woven through what look like total disasters.
Hmm?
We have to talk about the train story. Reed Finley, 1975.
The classic wrong train scenario, every traveler's nightmare.
So they're in Ulu. They need to go east to Kajani. They get on the train, but they pick the wrong line. They get on the west line.
And they get kicked off in the middle of a frozen wasteland, no station building, just snow, a taxi bus driver, and 8 hours to kill.
Most of us would spend that night just fuming, blaming our companion, blaming the schedule.
Right, for sure.
But Finley and his companion, they look at the driver and think, well, he's stuck here too. They spend the night teaching him. They give him a Book of Mormon. They turned a logistical failure into a captive audience.
It's all about reframing. If you believe there's some kind of plan, then there are no wrong trains. There are just different destinations with different people who need to be met.
It takes a lot of mental discipline to see a mistake as a divine detour.
A discipline they absolutely needed when we look at Kotka. Because if Kajani was lonely, Kotka was hostile.
Kotka was the crucible. Burke Reese gets there in 74 and just walks into a disaster.
The local branch had collapsed because of internal fighting. And even worse, the town had been totally poisoned against them by the local newspaper.
And we're not talking about, like, mild criticism. These were venomous articles. And the stakes were incredibly high. For a local member named Ville Lampinen, he worked at that newspaper.
And he was told explicitly, if you support these missionaries, you're fired.
Imagine that pressure. In a small town in the 70s, losing your job is a catastrophe.
So Reese and his companion, they decide they can't just lay low. They have to go on the offensive. They march right into the newspaper office and demand to see the editor.
It's such a bold move. They just refuse to leave the lobby.
And when they finally get in, Reese uses his outsider status as leverage. He tells the editor, look, I traveled 5,000 miles to connect with people, not to be slandered. He appealed to that Finnish sense of fairness.
And it worked. The editor didn't convert. This isn't fairy tale, but he backed off. The article stopped. And most importantly, Ville Lampinen kept his job.
It's a lesson in confrontation. Sometimes you have to walk into the lion's den to get it to stop roaring.
And out of that really hard soil in Kotka, we get maybe the most profound story of integrity in this whole collection.
Avo Jervenpää.
The missionary is called him the Golden Investigator.
Avo is the kind of character who forces you to look in the mirror and ask, do I really believe what I say I believe?
He was a literalist in the best possible way. He reads the Book of Mormon, sees the teachings on forgiveness, and just immediately applies them to his finances.
He had a wallet full of IOUs, you know, debts friends owed him.
And he didn't just nod at the scripture and think, oh, that's nice. He took those papers out and destroyed them, forgave the debts.
His reasoning was so simple. If I want to be forgiven by God, I have to forgive other people. He didn't rationalize. He didn't separate business from spiritual life. He just did it.
He also had this beautiful, simple way of explaining theology. The missionaries asked him if he understood God being the father of spirits.
And he just points to his 5-year-old son, Harry.
And he says, just as I am the father of Harry physically, God is the father of my spirit. Perfect. Just perfect simplicity.
But that integrity came at a massive cost. His wife was not on board. She gave him an ultimatum. It's the church or me.
And he chose the church. And it led to a divorce.
We often gloss over that part of religious history. We like the happy stories where the whole family joins. But sometimes faith is a sword that divides. Avo paid a very heavy price.
The journals do give us a resolution, though. Years later, Reese meets Avo again. He had remarried, he'd met a woman at a church conference, and he was serving in the temple. He found happiness, but he had to walk through fire to get there.
And that's the reality these journals document. It wasn't a highlight reel of miracles. It was a grind. I mean, the physical toll they describe is exhausting just to read about.
Oh my gosh, trudging through knee-high snow, carrying their bicycles on their shoulders because the roads were just impassable.
Living in servants' quarters on farms, the sleep deprivation.
There's this one image from Burke Reese that I just can't get out of my head. He wakes up at 3 a.m, he's on his knees. He realized he fell asleep in the middle of a prayer. He looks over.
And his companion is also asleep on his knees.
They literally worked until they lost consciousness.
That level of exhaustion, it forces a change in how you operate spiritually. You can't run on your own fuel anymore.
Vern Bowden mentions this in Kajani. He talks about learning to counsel with the Lord.
Which is a phrase from Alma 37 in the Book of Mormon.
Right. But for Bowden, it meant shifting from monologue to dialogue. He stopped just talking at God and he started, you know, listening. He says, I learned things that were meant just for me.
That's the pivot point, isn't it? When you're stripped of your comforts, your language, your physical energy, you finally stop broadcasting and you start receiving.
So pulling back from all these frozen snapshots, we have the humor of the Saxholms, the scarcity of Sister Korhonen, Ritva's long-tail influence, Alvo's integrity. What's the synthesis here? What's the takeaway for someone who's not a missionary in Finland?
I think it comes back to that serial nature of life. Like Sister Korhonen waiting for the next chapter, we're all living life one page at a time. We don't know the end of the story.
We don't.
We don't know if the person we talked to on the wrong train is the most important contact we'll ever make.
We want the movie script where it all resolves in 90 minutes. But these journals show us that the resolution might take 40 years.
Or longer. And that creates this sense of responsibility. You are currently writing chapters in other people's biographies that you aren't even aware you're a part of.
That is the thought I want to leave you with. Think about the invisible threads in your own life today. The text you send, the patience you show a stranger, the quiet prayer you offer for someone. You might think it's a throwaway moment. But 40 years from now, someone might point to today and say, that was the moment everything changed.
We're all missionaries of something, whether we wear a name tag or not.
So make sure your message is one worth delivering. Thanks for deep diving with us into the Finnish winter. We'll catch you on the next one.
Goodbye, everyone.